Okay, we're going to finish the book of Job today, and I want us to begin by reading chapter 42, and I'll read the first six verses here. This is at the end of God's address to Job. Job has repented of his presumptuousness, I guess I would say, but in 42 it says, "Then Job replied to the Lord, 'I know that you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. You ask, who is this that obscures my counsel without knowledge? Surely I spoke of things I did not understand, things too wonderful for me to know. You said, listen now, and I will speak. I will question you, and you shall answer me. My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes.'" So I think this is reveals to us why Job felt he needed to repent. You know, he admits his guilt, he repents of it, and he says that before he had heard of God, now, he says, "I see you with my own eyes." So I think he has a much deeper and intimate understanding of who God is. I think the encounter has opened his eyes to a God that is far greater than anything he imagined. And I think this is just what I think, because what God said, if I had been mad as Job, what God said to me wouldn't have changed my mind. You know, what he said wouldn't change your mind, but the very fact that he has appeared to Job, I think, is what affected Job, caused him to repent. It says, "I think that God's love and care for not only him and all creation is what Job sees in the fact that God came and spoke to him." And that's sufficient for Job. I think he realized God had not abandoned him. God was not his enemy. God was not punishing him. God was with him and for him throughout the whole ordeal. And so that's what I think Job realized, because like I said, if I was as mad and angry as Job was and accusative of God, then God asking me a lot of questions I couldn't answer wouldn't change my mind. But if I realized who God was, I had, you know, we talked last week about having an epiphany, a revelation of who God is and his greatness, you know. So that's my thoughts on why Job repents. Let somebody read the end of the chapter, 42 verses 7 through the end of the chapter.
"After the Lord had said these things to Job, he said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'I am angry with you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. So now take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job. Sacrifice a burnt offering for yourselves. My servant Job will pray for you, and I will accept his prayer and not deal with you according to your folly. You have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has.' So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite did what the Lord told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. After Job had prayed for his friends, the Lord made him prosperous again and gave him twice as much as he had before. All his brothers and sisters and everyone who had known him before came and ate with him in his house. They comforted and consoled him over all the trouble the Lord had brought upon him, and each one gave him a piece of silver and a gold ring. The Lord blessed the latter part of Job's life more than the first. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 donkeys. And he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. The first daughter he named Jemima, the second Keziah, and the third Karen. Nowhere in all the land were there found women as beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father granted them an inheritance along with their brothers. After this, Job lived 140 years. He saw his children and their children to the fourth generation, and so he died, old and full of years.
Okay, and thus ends the poem about Job, okay? Notice three times here in the verses 7 through 8, 7 and 8, God refers to Job as his servant. Job is still, he's rebuked Job, right? But he's still God's servant. And he says he's displeased with Job's friends. And they're instructed to go to Job and make an offer of sacrifice, and he will accept the sacrifice when Job prays for them. He said he's angry with them because of their foolishness and their folly. And I think the reason he's angry with the friends is because of their theology. You know, they said basically God punishes people in real time, punishes the wicked. He rewards the innocent, he punishes the wicked in this life, in the real time. And God says that's foolishness. God doesn't work that way. Okay? That's very close to the modern prosperity gospel. You know, somebody mentioned that earlier in the class. I think John did, right? We want to influence people to be Christians, and so we tell them God will bless you if you become a Christian, and it's certainly true. You know, a Christian life is very... But that doesn't mean God's going to give you riches. It doesn't mean God's not going to allow suffering in your life, right? And so the prosperity gospel is false, just like Job's friends. But because of their theology, they condemned Job, because the conclusion was Job obviously is a wicked man because he's suffering a great deal. So God must be really punishing Job, so he must have really committed some sins. But in verse 7 and 8 here, he says Job spoke what is right about him. Now that's interesting, because everybody in the poem, you know, Eliphaz, the three friends, God, the author of the poem, they've all told us what Job said that was wrong. You know, so the question is, what did he say that was right? What did Job say that was right? And I, you know, this is me again, but I find three things when you go back and survey the chapters, three things that I think Job said that was right. First, if you look in chapter 21 and 24, I said in an earlier class that Job was a little slow to begin to counter their argument, to give another understanding of God. He's too busy complaining about his suffering. But here, I think this is in round two of the debate, in verse 6 here of 21, Job says, "When I think about this, I'm terrified. Trembling seizes my body. Why do the wicked live on, grow old, and increase in power? They see their children established around them, their offspring before their eyes." And he goes on to describe what a good life a lot of wicked people have, right? And he says, "They spend their years in prosperity and go to the grave in peace." This is verse 13. "Yet they say to God, 'Leave us alone. We have no desire to know your ways. Who is the Almighty that we should serve him? What would we gain by praying to him?'" So Job basically is, they say God punishes you in their life. Job says, no, they don't. No, God doesn't do that. That's not the way God does things. So I think that's right. I think God would say Job is right here. So this is one place that Job is right to him, what he says about God.
He says one other thing there in 16 about their prosperity is not in their own hands.
Yeah.
And he right about that.
Yeah, in other words, ultimately, their future, their destiny is in God's hands. But he does not punish the wicked in real time. And that's what the friends are saying. And he says, he repeats this in 24. Let me see where that is. He starts off, he says, why does the Almighty not set times for judgment? Why must those who know him look in vain for such days? And then he goes on to describe, through about the first half of this chapter, all that the wicked do to oppress the innocent. And he says the end of verse 12 there, he says, all the wicked do all this to the innocent, oppress them, but God charges no one with wrongdoing. So, contrary to what Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar say, God, who is a just God, pretty much allows the wicked and the just free will in this creation, right? And that, I think that's what Job says that's right. So in terms of blessings and punishment, Job says God can't see where God, Job says he can't see where God does, makes any distinction between the wicked and the innocent in this life. And I think that agrees with what Jesus says in Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount. He says basically, and let me, I tend to want to paraphrase, but let me read that exactly here.
What chapter are you still chapter in? 24? Are you still in 24?
Too? I'm leaving 24.
Okay.
The first part of that chapter, he says basically, God doesn't set a time for judgment.
Yeah.
And even though the wicked oppress the innocent, God doesn't charge him with wrongdoing in this life. In chapter 5, at the end of that chapter, he says, talking about God, he said, he causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. So God blesses the wicked just like he blesses the righteous. We don't have an advantage in terms of material blessings or an absence of suffering in this life. I think that's what Job is saying, and I think that the Gospels agree with that. And I think that's one thing that Job said that I think that God would have said. That's right, Job. Two others. In chapter 14, this is where Job is in tremendous depression and suffering, and he says, he speculates about life after death. He says, if a man dies, will he live again? And then he goes and he says, basically, if that were true, my suffering would be a whole lot more bearable in this life. If I knew that God would call me forth after death, and that I would have a relationship with God where God was my friend and his wrath was no longer on me. So I think God would agree with chapter 14. You know, we said chapter 14 and chapter 28 are kind of poems within the poem, and is totally attributed to Job. And so I think in 14, God would be shaking his head, yes, that's right, when Job said that. In 28, that's the chapter about the wisdom of God. And he says, Job says, you know, people go to all kinds of work and struggle to find treasures. They dig down in the ground and go where no other being or no other animal would go, hunting for treasure, and the treasure we need is the wisdom of God. And he says that God alone understands it, but God tells us what we need to know. He says, at the end of that chapter, he says, God says to man, fear the Lord, that is wisdom, and to shun evil is understanding.
You think this comes down to, too, you know, people always tell you God's never going to do something to you, you don't think you can't handle it yourself.
Yeah.
You think he chose Job there because he knew that he wasn't going to go against him, no matter how much suffering he went.
Well, I think Job represents the best of humanity, okay? And I think that God had a lot of confidence in Job. You know, you get the impression, I heard people say, well, he did this to see what Job would do. I think God knew what Job
exactly
would do.
Exactly, he didn't know what he was going to
yeah,
do.
So, I think that he had a lot of confidence in the man Job. But I'm not sure we would not all do that well.
Right.
Okay. But we can blame Job with, you know, being presumptuous for accusing God and for darkening God's counsel. He said a lot of things that are not right. But I probably would have given up.
I think we'd all say something.
Yeah.
Why are you doing this to me?
Yeah.
Well, he did say that.
Yeah. That's what he wanted, the question. That was his main question, and he never got answered, right?
If God knew what Job would do just from the get-go, other than the story for our benefit, why does anybody get tested if he knows the answer? Why put us through it?
Good question. I don't have an answer. A good answer.
Before he doesn't know. And he's
I wonder about things like that a lot. You know, why did God go to so much trouble to send Joseph to Egypt? You know, why didn't he just wait till time to go and tell him to go? You know, he sent him down there when he was a young boy, and he went through all this persecution and suffering. And then Joseph says he did that to save lives, to save Joseph's family.
In my personal life, I think I've learned to, through my adversities, to trust and obey God.
Amen.
I think. The more I have experienced in a negative way, the more my faith is in God and the fact that He sees me through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trust and
that
obedience.
And that comes with experience.
Yes.
You weren't there when you were 20 years old.
In my case, anyway.
But, you know, we said in chapter 28 that God tells man, this is wisdom as far as you're concerned. Fear me and avoid evil. That's all we need to know. So, wisdom from God is not having the insight to know what God's going to do in every situation. We said that. Wisdom from God is to know that regardless of the situation we find ourselves in, we should fear God and avoid evil. Do that, you're wise, according to God, okay?
The Bible says that Jesus was made perfect through his sufferings.
Right.
And that didn't mean sinless because he always was.
Right.
So there's some perfection that comes through that,
yeah,
even if we don't understand it.
And I think it's synonym would be he was made complete.
Yeah.
His commission was complete through what he suffered. So I think that chapter 28, God would be going, yes, Job is right there, okay? And then the other place, you can't avoid being impressed with what Job says in chapter 16. At the end of that chapter, he says, even now my witness is in heaven, my advocate is on high, my intercessor is my friend. As my eyes pour out tears to God on behalf of a man, he pleads with God as a man pleads with his friends. And then in chapter 19, Job in 23 says, well, actually 20, 25, he says, I know that my Redeemer lives and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him. With my own eyes, I and not another, how my heart yearns within me. So I think that those would be statements that God would, you know, say, Job's right, you know. That Job has the right attitude here about, and to me those are the most profound statements in the whole book. That these are declarations of Job's confidence in God's ultimate justice. That he's gonna have justice. He's going to be vindicated. He said that several places. I know that I will be vindicated. So that's my assessment of what Job said that was right according to God. Okay. We see Job is restored to health and prosperity. I think we looked at this passage last week, but 1,000 years later, over 1,000 years later, James, through the inspiration of the Spirit, uses Job as an example of patience and perseverance for Christians that are being, you know, suffering persecution. And here we are, 3,000 years at least beyond that. We can still learn perseverance and patience from Job, you know, as we go through our trials and sufferings and we wait for our redemption in heaven. So that's the end of Job. Anybody got any thoughts or comments or rebuttals or?
I got one question. I don't mean to back up, but when in Job 28, mm-hmm. where it said, "Behold, the fear of the Lord is wisdom," can you say that trust is part of the fear of God? In other words, it seems like trust is should be in there. I mean,
I would agree with that. I always wondered, well, what's wise about fearing God? But to man, that's all we need to know is fear God and you'll be all right. That's all you need to know to be wise. But yeah, but I think to fear God, you have to trust God.
Right.
You know, and I've heard people say, well, we don't fear God. Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
if God were to appear today, we'd all fall down.
I need you.
You know, so any other thoughts? I got a lot of stuff I want to talk about to summarize this class, but let me say this. My understanding is this is the end of Job. For the next 3 weeks, Greg Rigney has volunteered to teach this class on the wisdom literature, so it's kind of related. And then Alan is going to get back from Turkey, and he's going to teach. I think you'll teach Ephesians, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you learned something. If you have a different perspective now of suffering, maybe I've accomplished my goal. What I've done in the last time I taught this is I took the remainder of the last class and I said, what lessons have we learned from Job? You know, and I've got a bunch of them because I've thought about this for years, but I'd like to give you the opportunity. What lesson is the most relevant to you today from the book?
I think Job never gave up. He still believed in God. That was one of the main things.
And I think that shows his perseverance. You know, that's the we all want perseverance. But the only way to get it or to know that you have it is to go through some suffering, right? But yeah, never give up. That's a good lesson from the book of Job. Anybody else?
I think I explained it a little bit last week about, you know, this time. I've read it through in the yearly Bible study things, but this was I hadn't studied it for a long time in class. And when I was younger, I think I was terrified by all of the not knowing why Job and him knowing that he didn't know why either, and then the taunting and all of the things that from the people that meant the most to him, not giving him the right kind of advice. But I just suffered when I was reading it when I was younger, and I just couldn't. I just thought, well, I can't. I'm not going there for a while, you know, kind of thing. But
yeah.
Being in here in your class and hearing things differently and being much older, it's more comforting and less vexing than when I was younger. Yeah. I can see, just like you said, we're all going to go through it.
Yeah.
Some sort of suffering, levels of suffering, it's coming. So let's prepare. That's sort of the way I'm thinking.
Yeah, I've said about my mom and dad, my dad never thought he was going to die. He lived till he was 55, started having chest pains, and he died that night.
Wow.
My mother, who was 54 at the time, started planning her death right then. And she suffered greatly, And I'm thinking, God, I'd rather be my daddy than my mother. I don't want to suffer for 5 or 10 years before I die. You know, the old thing about best you can count on is to go to die in your sleep, right? So I pray for that, and I'm 78. I've suffered some, but, you know, I say, well, right now, if God sends me suffering like Job, I ain't got a lot of time left, you know. So, but you said something last week, and I wanted to share something. I'm going to jump ahead of my notes here. This is a little book, When Life Falls Apart. It's by a preacher in Asheville, North Carolina, at the Biltmore Church of Christ, where Phil and Joy Allen are now going to church, Michael Summers. And this book has got 9 life lessons, 9 chapters, from a series that he preached on Job. A lot more practical than I am. But you said life is not fair. That's what you said last week. Well, I thought, well, that's the first object lesson. Come in. That's the first object lesson from Michael Summers' book, Life is Not Fair. And the last lesson, you said, life is not fair, but I know life gets better. And that's the last object lesson from his book. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But, you know, when you're going through suffering, if you can just remember that, take it one day at a time. One, and you get through it. And then sometimes life doesn't get better, but in general, there will be better times in the future. And that's the first and last lesson from this book. And if we have time, I'll share some of the others.
I got one. I love what Laura said about, she brought up what I have trouble with. Working with the guys and his wife when they first come in, and later too, they think the guy's done them wrong. And he has put this bad and that on me. And I said, no, God is love. He does, and it's come for me to believe that God does not do bad things to me. Yeah. Stuff happens.
Yeah.
But what you came with the 3 different, that when you started today, that's proof. I can read something from these guys, and then I'd have to explain it because, you know, it took me to figure out what you were saying. But I'm over there, we said, well, you don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
I think you're wrong.
Yeah, a lot of times we blame God when we're...
Oh, yeah, they do it every day.
You know? And but I think you realize God, when you're suffering, it's not necessarily God punishing you.
Right. You know? So I think as far as the friends go, though, you got to be careful who you surround yourself with.
Yeah, we're going to get there. That's one of my object lessons. That's one of my things.
You're
going
to get free.
Friends like
John,
friends
problem
is that they thought God was looking out for them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a proper concept of God. God cares about them, but he's not protecting you in this world. I struggled with that for a long time. I thought the passages in the Psalms, well, in the Proverbs, it says, if you do this, life will be better for mm-hmm. you. I mean, that was the advice of a father to a son or a wise man to a young man. And you know, you just keep doing the right things and things get better. Generally, you saw that in life.
Yeah.
I saw that in all mm-hmm. my Christian friends. And
yeah.
then when tragedy strikes your life, you realize that's not true.
Yeah.
I mean, the generalization is true.
It's a realization.
You cannot count on it. People betray God, they betray you, and they just create havoc in your life.
Yeah, that's...
People have lost businesses. I mean, my brother experienced that. Someone he trusted spent up all his money and then sold his, arranged it to let somebody else buy his business as long as he was still in there. But the guy took it by just taking the debt. You walk away from it, you get nothing for your, you know, mm-hmm. all those hours and hours you spent building that business.
Yeah.
But he did it by spending up all the money and not ever telling him. Of course, it's foolish, my brother, not to watch the money in business. But, you know, if you trust somebody, they can really make you up.
Yeah, and that's one of the lessons from this book is friends let you down. You know, sometimes friends let you down.
Yeah.
You can't, there's sometimes friends are the greatest asset you have to get you through a hard time, but they're only human. You know,
never Satan's always working on whoever they are.
Okay. This is my list of lessons, and it's not in no particular order. But my first lesson is, and I've said this probably 10 times in this class, suffering is not evidence of God's wrath on you personally. Okay? Or it's not evidence that you've done something to displease him or that he's punishing you. It might be because you, like Job, were doing exactly what God wanted you to do. You ever think about that? You know, God, Job was so good that God called attention to him, you know.
Well, and that's certainly true in this world.
Yeah.
I mean, the world, the view, is not your view. It's not God's view. It's not the one God wants you to have.
Yeah.
So sometimes the suffering is because you're trusting him and doing what he wants you to do, and you're getting a little bit of resistance over here. You know?
You know, there's one other thing that I've learned, that my being here is not about me.
Yeah.
It's about God.
Yeah.
And if we think we're here for us to have a good life,
yeah,
God doesn't want to harm us, but he's here for to do his will, to accomplish his goals, which are holy and righteous, and ours are selfish.
Right.
That's reality.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't always want it to be selfish, but it is when we start examining ourselves. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I said that, you know, when you suffer, it might be your own fault, you know. It might be something you've done. It might be punishment from God. It might not be punishment, but it still be your own fault. You know, one of the things we said was, I can suffer because of my stupidity, right? I can do something stupid because I'm not perfect. God made me with limited knowledge, very limited wisdom, and I can do stupid things and suffer for it. But suffering might be a blessing in disguise. Okay? So, never assume that when you suffer, when difficult times come into your life, that God, don't ask yourself, God, what have I done? You know, if it's not obvious to you what you've done, don't go searching for guilt. That's another thing in here, is don't take on undeserved guilt. That's one of this guy's lessons. You know, Job repeatedly defended himself to the friends because they were trying to tell him he was guilty, and he wasn't guilty. Did I not say he wasn't a sinner, but to say that his suffering was because of his sin is what the friends were saying. Job's suffering didn't originate with him, and he was not to blame for it. And I think the converse is also true. If you're living a good life of comfort and health and wealth, it does not mean that you're doing what is pleasing to God. Or it's not evidence of your righteousness. And that's back to the prosperity gospel, right? The televangelists say that all the time. They want to convince people to be Christians, and so they promise them things that God had never promised you.
No. That's a great travesty.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's one of my lessons, and I'm jumping all over the place here, but we're terrible witnesses for God. You know, God doesn't need our defending him if we're going to do as bad a job as Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar did, right? So, all good things come from God, and they are sent to the righteous and the wicked. But Satan can use God's gift to draw us away from God, and God can use hardship and suffering to draw us to him. So that's the first lesson. Don't assume that you're being punished when suffering comes. Lesson two. If you're going to be a friend who's going to, you want to go comfort somebody that's suffering, don't be like Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, okay? They were his friends, and they traveled a long way to sympathize with him and comfort him. But when they got there, they wound up accusing him of sin and condemning him. They let their theology defeat their purpose. So remember, a suffering person does not need a lesson in theology. They assumed that Job had sinned. And you could say that they became satanic in a way. They were helping Satan torment Job. So they aided Satan, and God was not pleased with them at the end of the book. So if your goal is to provide comfort to a suffering friend, do it right. And I don't profess to know how to do this. I'm not. Women are a lot better at this than men in general.
Well, I think the friend started off okay in that they just sat with him.
Yeah.
I think it was, a week or so?
Yeah, for 7 days.
Right,
they
should have continued that, I think.
Yeah, and that's one of the points. Sometimes your presence,
mm-hmm.
and your condolences and, you know, your compassion and love is the best thing you can do. Don't give them a lesson in theology. Don't try to impress them with what... Don't say things like, God knows best. You know, you'll understand this someday, you know. I love that song. I love singing it. We'll all understand it by and by.
And that's true, but yeah, at that time... all that comfort to
you. Yeah, I think Michael says, don't tell somebody that thinks he will never understand why this, when he's going through it. Don't tell him he's going to understand it next week, because he's probably not going to understand it. You're not helping him at all. So, I say here, sometimes your presence, your expression of love and compassion is all that's really needed, and you don't have to have a profound message from God to be a comforter. Your silent presence is the wisest
thing. Sometimes you can just read some of those passages. That's good thing.
Yeah, I like to have a verse, but not a verse that says God punishes the wicked. That's not what you want to say.
Lamentations again. His mercies are new every morning.
Yeah. Job told his friends once, you know, when they were, I think they thought the best way they could help Job is to get him to convince his guilt and repent so God would quit tormenting him. But he told him at one point, if you'd just shut up, that'd be wisdom for you, you know. Just be quiet.
What appalls me is that they were supposed to be close friends, so you'd think that they would have leaned toward, you know, supporting him rather than accusing and condemning him.
Yeah. But you know, as we said in the description of their theology, when you have that theology, you think the best thing you can do to help somebody is get them to admit they're guilty. Then God can quit tormenting them.
Punish the victim.
Do what?
Punishing the victim.
Right, yeah. God.
I wonder, these guys are good friends of Job's. They watch the same life that Job described to us. And I'm not saying, I doubt certainly that he was absolutely perfect, though God never came back and told him, no, you were wrong about this. You didn't do that so well.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to see, and they had to, I mean, they could compare. There's an honesty about it that they needed to have,
mm-hmm.
that if this is happening to Job, then I am just as bad.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I find disappointing about people.
Yeah.
And I've seen it in church splits and stuff. People can be very close, and the next thing you know, someone finds out you have the doctrinal difference, and or they're selling you down the river, accusing you, and all kinds of things. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
But he said they had to come a long way to see him, so maybe they'd been gone a long time for him. They thought,
he must have done something in the interim, right?
Something different about him.
Yeah. Lesson 3, be careful when you presume to defend God, okay? They were defending God, but in the end, God didn't like their defense. And Job was still God's servant. And sometimes when we try to defend God, I think God wishes we'd just be quiet. You know, just don't defend me if you're not going to defend me in a good way, you know. He said they were guilty of folly and foolishness. And unfortunately, I think sometimes we are terrible defenders of God in our lives, you know. Lesson 4. Avoid anyone who tells you that they know why or how God causes specific events to occur other than what is revealed in the Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, we read that God sent the Israelites to Egypt, or that they sent the Babylonians to punish them. And we think when we see similar things in our life that God's repeating that, we can assume and we can draw parallels, but We don't know. We're not inspired by God to know. I've heard people say, God's doing this to this particular group of people in society because he's punishing them. I wouldn't say that for anything, you know, because I don't think we know what God's doing.
We don't know.
Where did we get to? Yeah, you can be sure somebody that tells you he understands God like that is trying to sell you something, you know.
He's deluded.
Yeah, he's deluded about his knowledge of God. Because we said that that's not what knowing God means, and that's not the wisdom of God. I said we can be sure of God's providence, but we can't explain how it works. We have no idea what the future holds, whether good or bad. So faith in God is really the only thing worthwhile. And trying to figure out everything to our satisfaction and to answer all our questions, I think that's an exercise in futility. Just fear God and keep doing what's right and avoiding sin. And that's wisdom to God. Lesson 5, God's promise to us is that he is with us. We're in the palm of his hand. He will never abandon us if we're faithful to him. Ultimately, the promise is that we will be with him in heaven in eternity, and there will be no pain and suffering there. But he also promises that there will be trials and sufferings along the way. So, I guess the fifth lesson is we're in a covenant relationship with God, but God doesn't tell us, he doesn't promise us that if we're in a covenant relationship with him, we won't suffer. And that's something that young Christians have to learn quickly, or they don't keep their faith, that it destroys their faith. I said, for evidence of this, look at God's people in the Bible. You know, it is a story of suffering for the innocent, you know, and the people of faith suffer throughout the Bible. I said, ultimately, look at Jesus on the cross for that. But Ruth, a beautiful example, Naomi said, don't call me Naomi anymore, call me Myra, which means bitter, because God has made my life bitter. They all suffered. So the prophets suffered. So don't be surprised. Don't expect God's promised you not to suffer. Lesson 6 is that God doesn't view our suffering or even our death as we do. We only see with a finite mind and a temporal existence. God's view is for all time and from both sides of death. And we're as much in the dark as Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and Job, when it comes to explaining God. But I think we do have a whole lot more revelation of God's ultimate plan for us than they had in the Old Testament. And I think that in the cross of Jesus, we have a suffering Savior to know and imitate. Okay. So, I said he doesn't view death and suffering the way we do. Psalms 116 says, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. And we think, tragic. You know, it is tragic to us because we hate to lose loved ones in this life. But God sees the death of a saint as precious. There's one of my favorite passages that I've used when poorly trying to console someone who's suffering is Isaiah 57. These are profound verses to me. The writer says, the righteous perish, and no one ponders it in his heart. Devout men are taken away, and no one understands that the righteous are taken away to be spared from evil. Those who walk uprightly enter into peace. They find rest as they lie in death. So, think about, well, death's a horrible thing, but It ain't the worst thing that can happen to you, right? If God takes me to protect me from falling away, take me now, God.
You know, while you're talking about that, you know, I lost my mother when I was 17. Yeah. You know, for a long time I was mad, you know, and angry. But then, you know, it's more you got to learn Christ. You know, I'm sort of looking at it more, you know, I got to know my mother for 17 years. You know, a lot of people don't even know who their mother is.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I think through life it prepares you for later on in life for things to come upon you. So, and I think like that's what this book has to do too, because it was preparing them.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what it came to my heart while you were talking about that. But
yeah.
I just wanted to share.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. There you go, right.
But yeah, lesson seven here, I said, God would rather we complain to him and call for an explanation, as Job did, than to try to defend him and do it badly. Remember what David Platt said in the audio we listened to, that he said that we want an explanation, but what we need is a revelation. He used the example of his broken arm, he's in severe pain, and the doctor standing there giving him a detailed description of why his arm is broken and what's... He said, I don't want to do that. So do something about this pain, you know. Well, that's the way we are. You know, we think we know what we want, but what we really need is a relief from our suffering, not an explanation of why we're suffering.
Probably wouldn't understand anyway.
Yeah, that's one of my lessons we're going to get to.
Well, the only relief we get sometimes is just knowing our relationship with God, and that God, that we're going to have to suffer, that God is there, and he's ultimately in charge.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no relief about for some things.
Yeah, there's no...
Your arm's going to hurt until you get painkillers.
Yeah.
And used not to be, used to be there were none.
And then you can't take too many of those or you get in trouble.
Yeah, they have their own bad effects, right? Yeah. I think the book is a study in the sovereignty of God.
Yes.
And that's, I think the ramifications of a sovereign God are kind of lost on us in the 21st century. Because we either think nobody's sovereign, or I'm sovereign. I'm the center of the universe, and what I say, I can do what I want to. I'm the measure of all things, you know. So, having a sovereign God as Lord, who does things that we don't always like, it's kind of hard for us to comprehend in the 21st century.
I want to edit something I just said. It's not no relief. There is perspective, I think, is about the only relief that we get. Seeing what we're going through from a different perspective. Sometimes, like, I know I experienced some severe pain once, and I thought, I didn't know what to do but yell. And then I realized it's not going away because I yelled.
You know? Sometimes you yell anyway, right?
Right. But it is almost more tolerable to
maintain an even strength.
Yeah, and just resolve myself to it. You know, and somehow or another, something
will be. I said that here, what God's sovereignty means is that he does what he wants to do. He's not answerable to me. He's not accountable to anyone. He's not bound by anyone. And he does not and will not defend himself to anyone. I think that's the reason when he appeared and spoke to Job, he says, I'm going to question you. You know, I'm not going to let you question me. I'm going to ask the questions here. God is the sovereign one. Job is not. I thought about that passage where in Deuteronomy 29:29, that says, the secret things belong to the Lord, but what has been revealed is, well, I forgot how what it says. Let's turn there. Deuteronomy 29:29. This is at the end of the law. God's given them all these laws to keep. And he says, let me get the secret things belong to the Lord, our God. But the things revealed belong to us and to our children forever, that we may follow all the words of this law. So don't spend your time speculating about what hasn't been revealed to you. That's the secret things of God. Focus on what you know, what has been revealed to you. Don't speculate about what we'll never know.
What is that passage?
Deuteronomy 29:29.
29:29?
Yeah. It says, basically it says, we're given all these laws, just worry about keeping these laws. Don't try to figure out the secret things of God. And I think that's something that mankind...
Except that you are not exceptional. Yeah. You will not have you will not have a lucid visit, you know.
Yeah.
And say, well, I know, because you know.
Yeah, another way to say this is you've heard all, if you've taken college literature or high school, you know, remember William Cooper? William Cooper, 1700s. He wrote a poem that we sing sometimes that says, God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. So I think that's, remember that, you know.
He suffered from Great Depression the night he wrote that poem, and he was going to the river to kill himself, drown himself, jump in the river, the Thames. And he got a guy, a carriage guy, like a taxi, you know, a carriage. And the guy he didn't know if he was drinking or what happened. But anyway, he went the wrong way, and Cooper couldn't get his relief, so he wrote the poem for us.
So God's providence took care of him.
Yes, that's right. In spite of his intentions.
Okay.
And that happens all the time, you know.
I'm going to jump through these because we're almost out of time here. But we ask a lot of questions that God's not going to answer. And sometimes we realize if he answered them, we wouldn't understand. It's like our children, you know, don't stick your finger in the wall. We don't have to give them a course in electrical engineering, just tell them, don't do that.
You know?
So, no matter how many questions we can ask, God's not going to answer a lot of them, and if he did answer them, we'd only have more questions, you know. So, lesson 10, Satan is the father of lies. He's the accuser of man. He believes that there is nothing worth saving in mankind, and he will accuse us before God as often as he can. And I thought, we don't need to accuse one another, right? We've got Satan to do that for us. We've already said that God had a lot of confidence in Job. I think Job represents the best of mankind. The 13th lesson here is that God has placed us in an amoral universe. We cannot make moral sense of the world as we understand it. But we accept by faith that God works in creation to bring about our salvation and to accomplish his will. I think that one hurdle for a young person's faith is the apparent lack of morality or justice in the creation. I relate this story. Judy Tuggle told me this over 10 years ago. She was watching PBS, and they were interviewing a guy, and they were talking about the beauty and the mystery of the creation. But the guy that was they were talking to was an atheist. And so they asked him, why do you not believe in God if you see the beauty and the mystery of the creation? And this was his reply. A worm in Africa can enter a child's foot and come out at his eye and eat his brain. So there is no God. Okay? But I thought, why is that bad if there is no God? Why do we think, where do we get the idea that that is a horrible thing? Why are we sickened and repulsed by that if there's no God? Where did the thought or the feeling that that's a horrible thing arise, if not from a loving God? To me, without the concept of a loving God, any discussion of good and evil doesn't make sense. Okay? So I believe there is a God because nothing else really makes sense in this life. If you do away with God, I believe in God because I believe in love. I believe that love and hate and moral values and justice and any sense of right and wrong doesn't make sense if there's not a God. I read a book by an atheist. It says there's no God because all we can find is energy and matter and time. You know? And that's all there is if you do away with God. And I believe when you do away with God, invariably, mankind gets lost in his concept of what's right and wrong. Last lesson is the book of Job is a lesson in patience and how to persevere. And these are things we all want, but unfortunately there's no way to have patience and perseverance or to know that you have them except to develop them through trials and suffering. Trials and suffering reveal whether we really have the patience and the perseverance that we would like to pride ourselves that we have, you know. I got 1 minute. Life is not fair. Sometimes friends fail you, is lesson two here. Sometimes friends are our biggest comfort, and they're what brings us through our darkest hours. On the other hand, friends can cause us some of the worst pain there is. The thing we have to remember is that our friends are human. They're fallible, just like we are. They're weak, just like we are. They have their own problems, just like we do. So, the book of Job is a wonderful and terrible picture of what friends can be.
Wives, too.
Do what?
Wives, too.
Yeah, wives. Yeah, well, hopefully our wives are our friends, right? Lesson three here, be careful how you judge. It says, be careful how you judge. Rarely do you know the whole story. This is a quote from the book. What's interesting about the story of Job is that none of the human characters had any clue about the opening scenes. The entire discussion is based on what they think they know, but don't. Okay? In the end, what they think they know about God and how he works is completely wrong. The whole book, okay? Don't take on unearned guilt. We talked about that. Our faith in God should not depend on our comfort. You know, we have to figure out a way to suffer and still have faith in God. Lesson eight is we can have joy in suffering, and the book goes to a great length as distinguish between happiness, which is circumstantial and external, and joy, which is internal. And lesson nine is life gets better. Okay? So I hope you enjoyed the class. We're out of time.